All right. Hi, everybody. Thank you for coming. Welcome to Cole Freeman and Mallon. My name is Dame Rothschild. I'm a partner here at CFM. Been with the firm for about 10 years now. I focus my practice on fund formation and advising investment advisors. We do a lot of digital asset work, but a lot of work with traditional fund managers as well. Back in the 4 days before COVID, we held events like this all the time. So it's really refreshing and great to see such a good crowd come out and to see the industry come together to talk about pertinent things that are happening. As you all know, we're here to talk about the SEC's new marketing rule. The marketing rule went into effect last November, November 4th, actually, so exactly 6 months ago. And I think all of us are dealing with clients who ask a lot of questions about it. How do we comply with this rule? What are the changes? What's new? What's the same? And so we thought now would be a good time to gather the industry and talk about what we've been seeing. I always like to lead off discussions about the new rule by comparing it and contrasting it to the old rule. The old rule was actually a couple rules and then hundreds of no action letters and interpretive guidance and other dicta from the SEC that guided how investment advisors were to comport themselves in the vein of marketing, whether it's private funds or just general investment advisory services. And so the prior regime, as I call it, was a whole bunch of different patchwork guidance. And if you take it all together, it basically boils down to, if I had to boil it down into two words, it's don't mislead. Don't mislead prospective investors. And the new marketing rule consolidates those two previous rules. So it was the advertising rule and the cash solicitation rule. And now being consolidated into this one marketing rule, all of those no action letters and all that interpretive guidance has been thrown out the window or incorporated into the new rule. It's all in one place. The SEC is releasing the new rule with 430 pages long. And yes, I've read every single one of them. And I can tell you that if it could boil it down to two words, it would still be don't mislead. Don't mislead your investor prospects. Sounds really simple, but obviously if the SEC thought there was 430 pages worth of discussion, the details are more complicated than it would at first blush seem. So the new marketing rule ditches the old regime, which kind of prescribed rules for every possible situation. And the new marketing rule adopts what the SEC calls a principles-based approach. Basically, they issue a bunch of high-level principles and they leave it up to investment advisors and their compliance and legal counsel to figure out how to comply with these broad principles. A little more specific than that, but that's basically what it is. The general principles are things like don't make material misstatements, don't omit facts that are material, don't purport to show claims that you cannot substantiate, things that all lead back to the overall theme of don't mislead. One question I get from clients a lot that I think is super important to address at the front before I introduce our distinguished panel is, the marketing rule applies to registered investment advisors, but I only advise private funds. Maybe I'm a venture capital manager and I'm exempt under 203L. Maybe I'm just an emerging manager and I'm exempt under 203M. What do I have to do to comply with SEC marketing rules? It's an astute question, and this marketing rule does not directly apply to those managers, exempt reporting advisors. The Advisors Act contains general anti-fraud and anti-deception and anti-manipulation provisions that apply to all investment advisors, registered or exempt. And so the SEC, buried in the 430 pages of the release around the new rule, said very specifically that it's a very thin line between what it considers misleading practices under the new marketing rule and what it considers to be fraudulent, deceptive, or misleading under General Advisors Act principles. And so even if you're an exempt advisor and the rule doesn't apply to you directly, technically, best practice is to comply with it as if it did. So with that, I'm going to introduce our panel. To my left is Mike Fitzgerald. He's Managing Director and Global Head of Cap Incro at TD Cowen. And to Mike's left, we have Fizza Khan, CEO at Silver Regulatory Associates. And to Fizza's left, we have Malhar Oza, Senior Associate at Cole Freeman and Mallon. So to start off, I'm going to ask this distinguished panel to just kind of give group their highlights and their sort of top of mind issues that they think of when they're advising clients and interacting with the new marketing rule. And Fizza, why don't we start with you?
I think, honestly, the biggest thing is about how to report performance. That is the number one question we get from our clients and from people generally who are interested in learning about the marketing rule. How do we report performance? When do we have to provide performance net of fees? Is it okay just to provide performance gross? Do we have to do it net? When do we have to do it? It's all around performance. So I would say that's the number one question we get. And then with that is substantiation. So similar to what you said, do not mislead. Along with that is the substantiation point. How can you ensure that the information that you are providing is actually accurate? You can prove what you say is actually true. Believe it or not, and we'll get into this, a lot of the language that you as managers want to put into your materials, you can't. And the reason why is, how do you substantiate that you are the best in class? You are number one in this space. If you can prove it, if you can substantiate it, let's have at it. But 99% of the time, you can't. So performance and substantiation of statements in your marketing materials, I think, are the biggest areas.
Awesome. Thank you. Mike, what do you think?
Well, we do a lot of work with newer emerging managers. And I quite like your point earlier with regard to whether or not they might be exempt, because even if they're exempt now, they don't want to be exempt forever. Everybody's goal is to grow and to be a registered advisor. And you sort of want to act like you've been there and are going to be there. And so creating a compliant environment, I think, is really important. And this is just frankly a rule that they have not spent a lot of time on. They might not be aware of it. And so we spent a lot of time doing a lot of consulting on, what it says and how it feels. And, in the vein of your two words, I would say just do it. Meaning you must bounce this off your attorneys. You have to really, or before you go out, just do it. Just go to your attorneys and make sure that you spend the time before you begin to distribute.
I think that makes a lot of sense. When you said just do it, I thought you meant just mislead.
So no. Okay. just give you more bill.
No, but I think you raise a really good point in that I think managers sometimes discount just how close you have to scrutinize marketing materials and every piece of them, like really every word, every punctuation mark, understanding the context around the information that's being presented, understanding the target audience. All of these are factors that go into making sure you are not misleading in the SEC's eyes. And so it's often a point that, it falls on deaf ears sometimes when it's coming from the lawyer, because sometimes people think, oh, they're just trying to pad more billable hours. But in reality, there's a lot of specifics that go into this. Alhar, what about you?
I think there's a couple of things. I think one of them is now the use of testimonials and endorsements. I think that's a big change in the cash solicitation rule, which was just previously just a rule. And, there was just elements you had to follow. Now, managers and especially digital asset managers that I work with a lot want to use social media a lot. And now you can get third-party communications either attributed to you or, you're making your own announcements on social media, either through, client endorsements, celebrity endorsements, traditional capital introduction services. So these are all things you kind of just have to keep in mind when performing your marketing activities. And so I think those two things and their integration to the new rule are super important to keep in mind.
That's very helpful. And I want to talk more about that as we get into the specifics of the new rule. So with that, Malhar, why don't you give us a rundown on sort of the big overview of the new rule? How does it, what is captured by the new rule? What kind of activity does the SEC think is marketing under the new rule?
Yeah, so there's kind of two prongs that are like the overarching definition of what's considered an advertisement under the new marketing rule. I think the first prong is like kind of what we think of as typically an advertisement. So that's going to be like communications from an investment advisor to prospective clients about advisory services that it offers. So just in practical terms, if I'm raising a fund one and I go out to potential investors and, with discussions about potentially making an investment in fund one, obviously that's going to be an advertisement. Underneath this prong as well is communications from an investment advisor to current client about new advisory services in this office. So if I'm a manager and I've already raised and closed fund one, but I'm moving over to fund two, if I go to my fund one investors and say, hey, and I talk about potential investment in fund two, that's going to be captured by the as an advertisement under the new marketing rule. The second prong are testimonials and endorsements for which compensation was provided by the advisor. So these are testimonials, endorsements that could be considered for like stuff like Mike does, traditional capital introduction services. That's going to be considered an endorsement, which is captured under the new marketing rule, or testimonials by past clients, current clients, or celebrity endorsements, which are going to be considered advertisements under the marketing rule. And just a note that when I say client, this also includes private fund investors. So it's not a direct advisory relationship, which creates whether it's an advertisement or not. It's basically, you know, if they're going out to investors, prospective or current, whether it's direct or through a private fund relationship, it's going to be considered an advertisement.
And I think that's different from the prior regime, right? I think under the old tax solicitation rule, it did not apply to investors in private funds.
The distinction was not made. And just to further piggyback off of what Mahar was saying, I think you also need to be careful as to what exactly you're putting into your materials. Because if you are a private fund manager, you're also subject to the general solicitation rule. So while Mulhar was emphasizing the purpose of why you're going out there with these marketing materials, what we consider traditional advertising materials, you also need to be careful as to what you are saying, actually speaking to in the public domain as it relates to your fund. And we can get in that. That's a separate topic in and of itself. But what we're referring to is when you are actually speaking to the advisory services that you provide. So what exactly is your strategy? What is your approach? How is it that you are technically different than other managers in the market? You're out there promoting, quote unquote, promoting a fund, but at the end of the day, you're actually speaking to and putting into the materials about your advisory services, just to be clear.
And I think one thing to note is also the medium that you go out there mm-hmm. and actually make these communications with. The old rule kind of limited to like radio, print, publication, and television. That's clearly, you know, thrown out the window now. And so this is an attempt to modernize it. So it's really any medium. It could be Twitter, podcast, Discord, Telegram, especially in the digital asset community. I think those are a lot of avenues used. And so I think it's important to keep in mind that the medium just does not matter. It's going to be any of these things that follow communication. Marketing.
So in what way, Mahar, is social media really being used in that way by managers? And how is the new rule capturing that?
So there's a couple of things. There's two concepts, I think, that are super important with respect to social media that the new marketing rule specifically mentioned. I think it's the concepts of entanglement and adoption, for example. I think one of these things is a third-party communication that the manager does not put out. So, and I see this, again, I'm going to liken it back to what I see with my digital asset clients a lot. If it's some sort of issuer releases a press release because they want to, you know, for their own ability to raise capital, they might want to say, oh, we partnered with XYZ, you know, capital management in order to raise, you know, funds. If they say stuff, you know, positive, flattering things about their partnership, you know, that this is a outstanding manager, they produce outsized returns for their investors or stuff like that. If the manager was to either be involved in creating that communication or was to just interact with it on its own social media, for example, retweet it, like it, repost it or something like that on LinkedIn, Twitter, whatever it is, it could be considered as having adopted that communication or been entangled with it, and liability will be put onto the manager with respect to that communication, even though it did not originate from the manager.
And so in that case, that communication, that original communication that the manager is retweeting, for example, would be considered an advertisement for that manager subject to all these rules.
That is correct. And it's, you know, you have to keep in mind the general prohibitions, the principles behind the marketing rule when even, you know, if you're going to repost or retweet something like that. And these are just things that now managers have to keep in mind, or whoever the CTO is of a firm, keep in mind when, you know, when their official advisor, you know, social media is being in use. Another thing that's on social media is that even personal usage of employees of a firm can be attributed to the manager. And that's something, again, this is a modernization of the rules, right? So if you have a principal tweeting from a personal Twitter account, depending on the content and depending on the interactions between the manager's social media and the principal's social media, it could be a liability could be you know, put onto the advisor there. And so you have to adopt clear policies and procedures to ensure that, you know, you're siloing a personal Twitter usage from the advisor's kind of usage of social media.
So maybe we talk about performance results of rules around it, because the new rule sets out very, you know, like I said at the beginning, it sets out sort of general broad level prohibitions, but it also has very specific rules around performance reporting and how you're allowed to present performance. And as Fizzle was alluding to in her highlights at the beginning, I think we get a lot of questions, or, you know, a lot of decks come across my desk where I see, you know, here's results from a prior firm, or here's results, you know, here are the results we've achieved gross of fees, and people don't want to back out fees or expenses. And so I want to talk a little bit about the rules around performance reporting.
Yeah, I think, you know, the biggest takeaway is that whatever type of performance you're reporting, you have to report it net of fees. And Dave and I were speaking earlier, and an anecdote I can share with you is a client of mine just before we got started contacted me and said, oh my God, you know, they're a private equity firm. They're about to do an acquisition, and there's no way that they can get the materials together in a timely fashion that would provide their targeted performance with net of fees. There's just too many calculations that have to go into it. And they said, can we put out these materials with it just stating that this is our performance? And then we collectively worked together to put in like a disclaimer saying that the net performance is forthcoming. It will be distributed to the prospective investors, et cetera. And this is a massive flip from what we had seen prior to the enactment of this new marketing rule. Prior to that, there was really no guidance by the SEC, nor was there any sort of anything in writing with respect to the rule as it related to net performance of investment level performance. So now we have an FAQ out there that says, yes, you must report investment level performance net of fees and expenses. And that puts all of you as managers in a bind, because essentially, how do you report this? Sometimes it's impossible to calculate. The advice that I think all of us share is do the best that you can. If there is a methodology that you can feasibly come up with that, A, you can substantiate and show how the calculation is made and why you make it that way, and you can consistently apply it, just use that. It does not have to be perfect. It does not have to ostensibly even make sense. It just has to be something that's in line with what you think really is going to project the performance as in a best balance way. We know it's very difficult to do this at the investment level, but now it has to be done. So I think that is the biggest hurdle that has to be overcome as it relates to any type of performance, whether it's actual, if it's performance from another firm, et cetera. And then Dave, Mahar, Mike, you know that there's so many ways to skin this performance cat. So what we would recommend is just put what you think you would want to project into these materials, and then let us review and figure out how to make it regulatorily compliant so that it falls in line with the rules, the regulations, your offering documents, what that has to say from a legal perspective. But there are just so many hurdles that have to be overcome. You know, we can certainly address them as they come up, but that's the key takeaway with performance, I would say.
Agreed. And just to drill down on that a little further, you know, the marketing rule generally says, you know, if you're going to show gross performance, you have to show net performance at least as prominently and in the same font and, you know, all that good stuff.
Very reminiscent of actual investment company requirements under the Investment Company Act, that's an actual requirement there for many years. So it just shows how registered products are now starting to seep into the private fund world.
Yeah. And I think when the rule first came out and when it was first released, there was a lot of uncertainty among managers because they want to, you know, fair enough, you want me to show net for the last year, for the last 5 years, for the last 10 years, I can do that. But sometimes I want to pull out a specific investment as a case study. And I want to show, you know, I had a great investment idea when, you know, COVID first hit and it turned out I was pregnant and it turned out really well. So the question among managers was, do I have to back fees and expenses out of that one specific case study? And there was a lot of uncertainty in the text of the rule. And all those 430 pages, it doesn't specifically say that you have to back out fees and expenses from each specific case study that you show. So the SEC has actually released a single FAQ since the rule went into effect 6 months ago, where they clarified that, yes, you actually do have to back out fees and expenses. And if you're going to have a case study and you're going to show the performance from one specific investment, you have to show it net. And so for some managers, that's easy enough to do. If you're, you know, maybe a VC fund or PE fund, that can be a little easier to do. If you're a hedge fund and you have hundreds of positions and, you know, one of them was really great and the rest of the portfolio wasn't, how do you back an incentive allocation out of that one position? And so I think that coming up with the right methodology and figuring it out, you might bang your head against the wall for weeks and months. And I think Fizz's point is that, you know, there's not a really great way to do that. And so the best that you can possibly do is come up with a methodology that you think makes sense, that you can repeat, that you can document. And then if you're ever under the microscope with the SEC, you can show them, you know, I didn't just pull this out of a hat. I actually thought about this and here's the method I used. And that's what I'm going to continue using.
In terms of the case study, though, isn't the workaround to not talk about performance? I mean, the reality is when you are invest in me, I'm amazing, my performance is incredible. Like, you have to win with your deck, right? The purpose of it is to talk through what your investment process is. And, you know, in my experience, those are the richest when the case study talks about winner or a loser. You don't talk about performance, you talk about how you came up with the idea, how you diligence the idea. And by the way, this is all consistent with the first 10 pages of your deck, which talks about your investment process and your portfolio construction. And then you got one that you got wrong and how you got wrong and what you did when you got wrong. You don't put charts in where you bought it, where you sold it. Like, no, but the workaround is like they want to understand how you think. You're talking about your firm, your vision, your culture, your investment process and your portfolio construction, what they can expect from you. And by the way, they're keeping track, right? We all know you don't get an allocation in the first meeting with your deck, right? So you got to be super consistent with respect to what you say you're going to do in meeting one, and then a year later in meeting five, when you think you're really close to getting an allocation. So these things are really consistent. And the case study stuff, like, I just think there's no upside to talking about the specific components of how you did on a name. And the real purpose, in my view, and I think with our clients, is, you know, that's a great example of what you told in the deck and how you think.
There is a general prohibition against cherry picking in a manner that is not fair and balanced. And there's a lot of fair and balanced talk throughout the marketing rules. I think someone at the SEC was watching a little too much Fox News at some point. So what does that actually mean? I think it means that you can't just pick one specific great investment and not mention anything else, right? I think that's pretty clear. There's also a whole regime governing extracted performance. And if you're going to extract a piece of the portfolio, whether it's one investment or whether it's a, you know, 3 month period or a sector of your portfolio, then you have to either show or offer to show the performance of the entire portfolio over that same period of time, which is sort of similar to how I would advise clients in the prior regime.
Yeah, you definitely, all of what we're discussing today, everything has to have some level of substantiation. So to the examples that you're bringing about the valuation, the examples that you were bringing about even just the testimonials and the social media, et cetera, it sounds almost trite, but you have to be able to document and substantiate whatever it is that is going into these materials. And it can be presented by way of third parties. You know, maybe there was third party data that you're using to support this information. That's fine. You have to be able to source it. You have to cite it. You have to reference it. It all becomes very much an academic exercise. It's not intuitive when you're doing marketing or advertising materials, but you have to think of it in that vein when you've put all this information together. I think Mike raises a really good point. You are trying to tell a story about you as the manager. You're trying to tell a story about the manager's process and why you as an investor should trust that process. And maybe performance isn't the best way to go about doing that, but ultimately we know numbers talk. And it's in essence, how do we utilize those numbers so that it's advantageous to you, but still in line with what the SEC expects? So again, fair and balanced. You know, it really is something that you have to be mindful of when ultimately you're trying to put together the story. And I think that's one of the things you were referring to with respect to social media as well. People want to tell stories over social media, and that's why the SEC is really harping in on how you're utilizing these different mediums to advertise.
Mike, I found your perspective on all of this to be pretty refreshing, because I try and tell, you know, sometimes I try and tell clients what you say, they're less inclined to believe it coming from a lawyer than they are from someone who sits in your seat. So I'm curious, from your perspective, you know, what are the other, call them red flags, call them, you know, things that get your hackles up? What do you see that managers want to show that you're, you know, especially inclined to tell them to run it by legal or run it by compliance?
Well, thanks, Dave. I don't know that we hold any more sway, you know, than anybody else, right? This is it's raising money is a really brutal, difficult, long process, as we all know. And, you know, now that you've got real or perceived like guardrails and so much to keep track of, you know, I just think it's really surprising a lack of general awareness of this rule and the need for compliance, or in our view, the need for an adoption of compliance of it, even if, like we mentioned earlier, you may be exempt. Like, you know, for us, it's, hey, listen, you know, we're not giving advice. I'm not giving testimony. You and I are going to get a real conversation later about what I do for a living, and you need to understand it. because you know, we talk to, allocators, and we take vetted and compliant documents, information from our managers. And so it's, for us, it's, hey, listen, this is like a thing. And by the way, you've put this in writing and you're emailing it all over the place. We don't send that information out. And so, you need to be aware of it. And whenever I hear prongs, right, immediately you have to understand there's event scenarios. And the real tough one is oftentimes you have someone, you know, launching business, a new firm, and they're leaving prior firm, and they either had the role of, you know, helping portfolio construction, or they, you know, created the, you know, the investment performance, but they've left prior firm. And I think the real rub there is exactly what we're talking about here, which is like, hey, I was a sector head and I managed this part of the portfolio. And, you know, you really got to be super careful on how you are talking about the portfolio. Like, there's plenty of ways for allocators to diligence you. Mm-hmm. Believe me, they're going to, in hard and soft ways. And in the instance where, you know, they're asking for information about your fund and providing it to basically me because I'm in like ninth inning of diligence with you, right? We need to blast that out to absolutely everybody. If it's an RFP where, you know, like, so there's things where you have to just, this is why you have relationships with, get quick answers and quick questions from your legal compliance folks. So for us, it,
like an awareness on the new manager side. And then additionally, they have managers that have been around for a long time, and maybe they have a dedicated market person, maybe they don't. Oftentimes they don't, the portfolio manager is the marketing person. And, you've got a compliance regime, you've got business firm to come in and do an annual inspection on everything that you are doing and making sure that, you're compliant. And if you're not, we need to fix that. Yeah. Right. And whether or not you're at the level of registering with becoming a registered investment advisor or not, like, we always advise clients to act out on an as-if basis, mm-hmm. right? You don't want to have to go back and learn. That's not a great scenario for institutional investors to say, so you weren't compliant yesterday, but now that you've grown, you're going to be compliant today. Well, awesome. So now there's new work that needs to be done operationally at your firm that, isn't happening today. So I guess we'll just wait until you are compliant so that we can diligence that that aspect of what it is you do and how you do it so that they are compliant. And you do not want to be an outlier on this, right? Investors are smart. They're seeing what your peers and your competition is doing. And if you're not compliant or you're doing something that, just is an oops because you haven't spent time on it, like, you only get a few shots on goal with these guys. And like, that's not a great scenario for you to extend a conversation towards now.
Yeah, I think that it's a great way to focus in on, even like my point earlier, even if you're not technically subject to this rule, to comply with it as a best practice, and allocators and institutional and sophisticated investors are going to want to see that you comply with it, and they're going to want to see that you comport yourself in a manner that is congruent with these rules and with what registered investment advisors are doing.
You'll just get a lot of nods and a lot of smiles and thank you for a great meeting. And then you'll wonder why your email's not being returned. It's like you'll be an outlier. And I think it's something you're really going to focus on. And so again, whether you're a new manager or whether you're an existing manager that maybe hasn't made sure your materials are sort of up to code.
How much pushback do you get from the managers that are your clients in regards to this? When you notice that there's clearly something that needs to be reviewed or that it's not up to what you know to be in line with regulation. I think I can speak for Dave and Mahar to the level of pushback that we tend to get when we do marketing material review. And believe me, we understand why we're getting that pushback. I'm curious from your end, the type of pushback.
Not a lot, honestly. I think we get to be the nice guys in this whole thing, right? Because we're just being like, listen, like, here's where you guys gotta go and speak, and you want to be compliant. I think it's new managers, it's a lack of general awareness about, like, really? None of us think, I'm just not a big fan of hyperbole in these documents. Like, it's sort of just what you're really trying to get across, what you do, how you do it, team, your bio, etc. And it's not a ton of pushback. I think sometimes it's like maybe with the existing manager, it's like, oh, really? But that's, I just wrap it into what their team is already doing, which is that annual compliance review. And look, you're archiving your emails, right? If you get audited by the SEC, right? It's just a simple, it's like brushing your teeth. You're doing these other things. Like, your marketing material has to be part of that, of that regime. Oh, good call. Thank you. So it's a little less. You guys could be the bad guys.
I see a lot of hyperbole in marketing decks, and it's one of the things that I always caution folks against. I think it goes back to a point that I was making earlier about substantiation. Right. You can say you're the first fund to ever do this. You can say you're the best fund at XYZ, but how do you substantiate that? Right. And some of the hyperbole that I see is frankly not possible to be substantiated. Exactly. I mean, if you got an article from the Wall Street Journal that said you're the best fund manager in, the West Coast, then great. Say that in your deck and cite to that article. but otherwise, you could avoid that hyperbole. Stick to the facts. And I think, to Mike's point, you're not winning any allocations with the hyperbole in the deck to begin with.
I can tell you just from personal experience that it's I know it's really difficult as a manager not to engage in hyperbole when it, and, you know, superlative language when you're putting together these decks, especially when you're in the portfolio manager seat or you're trying to manage the portfolio manager and what they're saying. And I think, again, there's as much of an art as there is a science to putting these materials together. And if you can just be very direct and factual, as you were saying, Mike, and just stick to that, that's great. But we know that's not going to happen. We know the portfolio manager is going to push back, and they'll want to, you know, create this beautiful illusion or story around why it is that they're who they are. And my advice is let them put everything in there as a first round. And then what we as your advisors should do is help you tell that story in a compliant way. So removing the hyperbole, giving you alternative language that you can use in order for you to be able to tell the same story. So instead of saying, it can be as simple as saying, you know, you're not the best, you're among the best. You're not number one, you are ranked high, you know, or again, everything is subject to interpretation. A lot of people may take issue even with that, and given the new marketing rule, rightfully so. But the idea here is just to be able to offer options to the language. So rather than editing out front, the manager is not going to do that. You're going to do that. Or if you are the manager, we will help you do that. But the idea is to land in a place with these materials that get you comfortable from the firm perspective of what you're trying to convey and get us comfortable as your legal and regulatory advisors. So there's that fair and valid position again, being as much of an art as it is a science.
Yeah, absolutely. What, Tisa, do you think the SEC would ask to see? Like, let's say I'm a manager and I get examined. What are they going to ask to see in terms of substantiation for claims in a marketing deck? Like, are they going to want to see an Excel spreadsheet listing out, you know, on slide 13, I make claim X, it's sourced from, you know, article Y, and here's the article? Or is it enough to show them the deck and say, yeah, there's the source right there, you know, that's good enough?
No, it is actually the former, believe it or not. We currently have quite a few managers that are undergoing SEC exams right now. And while it's still in the early stages of how they are going, they meaning the regulator, the SEC examiners are going to actually request an audit pursuant to the new marketing rule, what we've been seeing is exactly that. They're getting very granular, very specific. So if you do cite to a particular source, they want to see that source, like that you have it backed up. You're able to show line by line that it was cited in the Wall Street Journal that we were XYZ123. And obviously with respect to performance, if you include performance information, they will want to see exactly how it was calculated, exactly what fees and expenses were included in the calculation of the net performance, et cetera. All of that they are digging into. We've seen this firsthand. So it's just as you are putting together these materials, it really makes sense for you just to side by side include the documents to substantiate each of these points and have it as a part of your books and records. So hopefully, even in the calculation of performance, you're doing that anyway for other reasons outside of your marketing materials, whether it's with respect to valuation or, you know, your financials or what have you. But make sure that you have that as a part of the overall documentation behind your marketing materials as well. Even if it seems duplicative, just have it as a part of that.
Yeah, I think that's a bit of a change from the prior regime. You know, my comments on both decks when they made a claim was, hey, make sure you have a source for the claim.
Right.
Or make sure you cite a source for the claim more specifically. And now it's probably more in the vein of, you know, make sure you cite a source and also keep that source in your records and make sure you have it ready to show the SEC when they come into your office.
Definitely.
All right. Well, everybody, thank you for coming. Thank you, panelists, for your insights. So we're going to have some food over here. The team's going to unwrap the food. There's a bar outside. If you want to grab a drink, please stay and mingle. And thank you all for coming.
Thank you.